Welcome to Aren't We Live number 10, unlocking private markets for retail investors, reshaping the alternative funds industry. My name's Jim Kent, and you'll be amazed to know that only 10% of European retail savings are currently held inside of investment funds. The vast majority of savings remain in bank accounts. But in the last 5 years, the global macroeconomic situation has changed. Of course, high inflation, low interest rates environment has left investors searching for better yields to rebalance their portfolios towards alternative assets and private markets in particular. Now, despite the higher interest rates, the trend seems here to stay. Meanwhile, managers are looking to the retail market as a new distribution channel and source of funding. But how can private markets be unlocked for retail investors? And what part does the fund industry have to play in that? Now, today we're speaking to three experts in fund formation and fund distribution. On my left-hand side, I've got Nicolas Bouvachet, a partner in the investment management practice here at Arendt. Nicolas, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Opposite me, I've got Fiona de Wattasi, a partner in the investment management practice. Fiona, good morning.
Morning, Jim.
And on my right-hand side, I've got Alexandre Leniger, a director at Arendt Regulatory and Consulting. Alexandre, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Now, can we first start by setting the scene? What exactly do we mean when we talk about the retailization of private markets? Nicolas?
Actually, I think in your questions, you have really three questions for me here. The first is the what, of course. What are we talking about here? The second is the why, and I think more importantly, why now? So the what, well, this is really about how retail investors access private markets. When I say retail investors, I mean any investors that is not a professional and institutional investor. Private markets, what are private markets? Well, any market which is, well, not public markets, so anything else than, you know, listed securities, bonds, things that you can
find. Not the stock market. Then.
Exactly, yeah. Got it. So talking about private equity investment, real estate, private credit, infrastructure, all these private asset classes. Why are we talking about this? Well, for retail investors, private markets are not easily accessible, right? You have no direct access, they're risky, they're costly to invest in, they're long-term, and they're not liquid. So really, your only option is to go through an investment fund to get access to those markets. But the thing is, until now, those markets were only proposed in investment funds designed for institutional investors, so closed-ended funds typically reserved to, you know, big-ticket institutional investors. And that means also for managers to be giving access to a broader audience of investors, you know, the model needs to change. And that's what's interesting, that is because this is happening now, basically. So that's the interesting part, is this the why now. And I think there it's basically a combination of two factors, two forces joining together. First, on the investor side, I think, as you said in your introduction, the macroeconomic situation means for investors that, well, if they want better return, they need to turn to private markets.
Because let's face it, it's been very difficult to get good returns, hasn't it, over the last 5 years?
Exactly. It's been difficult. I mean, it's been perhaps better lately, but the thing is, it's different. And this is a trend that is, you know, that is been going on for a few years and which I think is here to stay. In any event, I think investors now want to diversify with their portfolio. They want access to those private markets. So diversification is also important. I think there's a broader trend of investors wanting to invest in real asset, in the real economy. You know, it's part of the kind of sustainable investment type of approach that is being obviously pushed a lot in recent years. So this trend is in motion on the investor side. But then what's interesting is that this is really now met by a trend on the manager side, where we've seen that in recent years that, you know, institutional fundraising has been more difficult for managers. So it's more difficult to grow your institution investor base. They're also facing more pressure from their, you know, private bank and distribution clients. Those guys want to have their product, and so there's high demand there. And kind of the combination of those factors mean for managers that they've shifted from a dynamic of, you know, accepting retail investors in their funds through different structures to a different dynamic where they really go and search for that investor base. And that's a very fundamental difference in the industry.
Now, Fiona, Nicholas says that these markets have previously been closed or at least limited entry. How are we going to open these markets to investors?
I'd say there are really three key ingredients here. So product, the first one is product. You need to have the right type of fund that would cater to the needs of the retail investor. The second one is probably the right legal and regulatory framework. So you need to have the right legal framework which will allow you to build these funds and also distribute these funds. And then the third one is distribution channels, because obviously you need the right distribution network to be able to reach these retail investors.
So by distribution channel, for example, previously this was retail banks, wasn't it, selling products to their clients?
Indeed, that's the traditional distribution network that's been used for the traditional uses, funds, the retail funds that we all know. On the private market side, this was not always the case. They don't go through banks. They will sell face to face. So there is a shift that needs to happen on the manager side to also be able to reach these retail investors.
Right, Nicholas, let's talk products for a second. When we talk about products, what do you actually mean by that?
So the types of funds that are being sold to retail, you know, they're very different from institutional funds. As I was saying earlier, the typical closed-ended fund model, 8 to 10 years, you're locked in there. It's a drawdown type of fund. It's really meant and designed for an institutional investor base. You can't really sell that to retail, and actually you don't want it because it's difficult to maintain. So what managers are doing now is designing products which are really adapted to the needs of retail, of a broader retail audience. So what does that mean? Well, you need to offer private market exposure, private market returns. You need to do this in a kind of diversified manner. You need to have your sustainability and ESG policy in place, because that's also something that you know investors expect. You need to have those products available off the shelf. So that's a very important point, because if you look at the closed-ended model, well, there's an offering period. It's there for some time. You're in, and then you're locked. And if you miss that offering period, well, you need to wait for the next vintage, or maybe you go to another manager. That's not how distributors want to sell those products to a retail audience.
So this is because you expect that retail investors, they want more flexibility in their investment portfolios?
I think they want to, exactly. They don't have the same investment cycle as institutionals. They basically want to be able to walk in and say, okay, what do you have? And let's talk about, you know, how we can allocate part of my portfolio to private markets. So that's an important point. And also they want to have some possibilities of exiting the fund earlier than the term if they really need to. So all of these factors mean that we've seen in the last 12, 18 months, a big rise in what we call semi-liquid fund offerings. And that's across all asset classes. So a lot of PE, but also private credit and infrastructure. And by example, you've seen in the press announcements by, you know, Blackstone, Apollo, Goldman Sachs, all these big players have now semi-liquid or semi-open offering for retail.
Now, Fiona, I know that you're a regulatory specialist. What is the specific legal and regulatory framework for these products?
I think there are really two levels. So obviously there's an EU level and then there's a local level. At the EU level, we have since 2011 the AIFMD directive, which has actually provided a regulatory framework and has kind of regulated these alternative funds indirectly by regulating the managers. We also have MiFID, which serves an important role because it regulates the financial markets and provides investor protection. So, for example, we need to ensure that a product is suitable and appropriate for the retail investor. We need to ensure that we're providing the right investment advice prior to investment to these retail investors. So those are really two important components at EU level that have obviously been adopted in Luxembourg. And then we have local laws and local regulations, and we need the right funds to be able to allow to target retail investors, and also to have investments in private equity, real estate, private debt, infrastructure, so all these private assets. In Luxembourg, we're very lucky to have a good fund toolbox. It's really ideal. So we have really two types of AIFs that we're seeing and that host these types of investment strategies. We have the Part II fund, which is a Luxembourg type of fund, which is open to all types of investors, so including your retail investors. And then we have RLTIF, which is actually a European label, but which works perfectly with our Part II fund, and which allows the broad distribution to retail investors. But to be honest, LTIFs have faced some constraints in the past years, because under the old LTIF regime, so what we called LTIF 1.0, there were certain constraints on the asset side and on the distribution side. So constraints in terms of what you could invest in and in what proportion, and also how you could distribute these funds to retail investors. And I think Luxembourg has proved itself to be an amazing domicile for these funds. And what we see today is that the CISF has really developed its knowledge and practice of these types of funds. In terms of LTIFs, Luxembourg hosts around 60% of LTIFs that have been created so far. So there's a real expertise in Luxembourg. And that goes, that's the same also for the service providers that we have in Luxembourg. So the AIFMs, the depositories, and all the service providers that revolve around a fund have also built this real knowledge of the product.
So this is, once again, illustration that Luxembourg is quite quick at transponding EU law into local law, correct?
Absolutely.
However, would you say, have LTIFs really gained traction yet in the market, or do you feel we're very early on?
So LTIFs have obviously been in existence for a few years. When we look at the total number of LTIFs that have been created so far, around 90 in the EU, with 60% of those being created in Luxembourg. Obviously, we could have expected that these numbers would be higher by now. And as I mentioned just previously, there have been certain constraints that have made it quite difficult to actually create the strategies that managers wanted to create in an LTIF, or to be able to effectively distribute the fund to retails. This is going to shift, and we're going to start a new regime in January with LTIF 2.0, where the Commission has really brought solutions to the problems that were kind of, that were limiting the uptake of LTIFs.
So clearly, the interpretation of the policymakers is that they think this structure is good news for the market and that the market needs it.
Absolutely, because it's investing in the real economy. So it really goes hand in hand with the Commission's, aim. And it's a vehicle that allows to target retail investor whilst giving them the necessary protection and regulation. So it's really something that is being promoted, and that is why that we're seeing the Commission wanting to bring these solutions to the LTIF regime.
And that's keeping us quite busy, if I can add. I think when we discuss structures with clients, I think the LTIF word, will always come up in the discussion. So there are still some limitations, but I think the benefit of this regime and the push that it could give to the market is very real.
So managers seem to be in favor, investors seem to want it, and policymakers are clearly happy with it. Now, Alexandra, let me just bring you in here. How do retail investors actually invest into these products?
I think to answer these questions, really, I would like to address three points that are really key. The first one is who we are talking about here. What is retail? And retail is surely not grandma, not in this context. So from a pure regulatory aspect, we do consider retail investors as being the opposite of professional investors. But in this context, for alternative investment funds, we do refer to high net worth individuals, private wealth markets.
So, in fact, the word retail is a little bit misleading, because we're not talking about very, very small investments.
No.
Right, got it.
No, definitely not. Not the pure retail as you and me, but much more with, let's say, as I said, private wealth investors, really. For this type of investors, I think distribution is all about how. And as Fiona mentioned before, unlike what alternative investment fund managers were used to do so far, the retail access is not organized the same way. It's not a direct marketing. They would have to go through marketing intermediaries with the right investment advice, because investors would need the right advice to invest, and in marketing intermediaries would have to, let's say, make sure that the product is suitable to the investors. And that's not the same as when you are speaking to professional investors.
And what you're trying to say is that the rules for marketing are different depending which jurisdiction you're in.
That's not exactly it. But still, if you refer to what we speak about the product registration itself, that's right, that depending on what type of product you have, the regime of registration or the accessibility to this product would be different. If you have like an LTIF, that would be through the marketing passport. If you have like a standard AIF, then you go to local regime that would be applicable. But I was actually in the intermediated, let's say, marketing. I was much more saying that in any case, if you want to sell to retail investors, you need to provide like a suitable investment advice, and you need to make sure that the product is appropriate to the investor.
Right, got it. Now, what about the regulatory point of view on this?
In terms of the product registration?
Cross-border.
Cross-border, that's it, actually. The point is that, as I said, if you want to sell on a cross-border basis, then you would have to register your product. That would be the idea. But depending on the product, you would have access to an harmonized process rather than for other type of vehicle. You would need to look at every countries where you would have a different regime applicable.
I must admit, this seems pretty complicated. It seems as though some of the rules are harmonized and some of them are local. That must be a nightmare for asset managers, mustn't it, Nicola?
Yeah, I think you're right, Jim. Hopefully, you know, they have good lawyers to help them. But I think the thing is, it's all new for them, right? It's new for distributors, as Alexandra just explained. Distribution, you know, has its own challenges. Regulation, we just discussed, you know, it's not harmonized because at the end of the day, there is this is kind of a new market still. So regulation is a challenge, you know, finding the right partners and distribution channel is a challenge in itself. But it's also new for GPs. So they'll need to look at, you know, things like liquidity, valuation, you know, portfolio construction, fund structuring in a whole new different way, very different from the traditional, let's say, closed-ended fund type of product that they were selling before. And obviously, it's new for investors as well. So let's not forget that.
Right, I get it. So you're saying this is a completely new way of, a new model, in fact, for investments, particularly looking at Europe. But I'd like to discuss now a few more about the challenges for asset managers. So for asset managers who are tuned in right now, I know that one of the words that I hear them say a lot is liquidity. Is that a challenge?
Yeah, liquidity, I think, is indeed, you know, the word in everyone's mouth when talking about challenges of this product.
After all, these are infrastructure funds, right? We're talking about bridges and tunnels. Of course, that they're not liquid, are they?
They're not liquid. And it's not because you put them in a fund that they become liquid. It's not magic. So you can't, you know, turn an illiquid asset. Private markets will always be, well, for now at least, illiquid. But what you can do is manage the liquidity that you offer to investors versus, well, the liquidity in your portfolio and the other way around as well. So you need to adapt. You need to find the right balance between investor expectations and, you know, creating value by long-term investment in those assets. And that has a fundamental impact on product design. So in terms of portfolio constructions, managers will need to look at this differently, at the type of assets that they invest in, the liquidity that they keep in the portfolio. So whether they want to keep a bigger liquidity sleeve in the portfolio, diversification, that's also an important point to get to that balance. On the other side, they'll need to consider carefully liquidity terms. So what are you offering to investors? How do you make sure that the product is adapted to retail investor needs, but you keep the flexibility to, you know, manage your portfolio and create that long-term value? That's very important. And in that context, I think transparency is very important. You need to make sure that the terms are clear, that investors understand what they're getting into.
Transparency, I find that an intriguing word, because a lot of, historically, asset managers have always said, oh, you know, we are transparent. But actually, investors, I think, are pretty stupid. I think investors often don't know what they are really investing into. Do you think actually, is it possible for asset managers to be transparent?
I think that's the objective of a lot of the new legislation that we see coming is investor protection. So investors need to be protected. I'm not saying that they're stupid, but I think we're talking to a retail audience here. So potentially, well, they're not professional by default. They might be sophisticated, but still, you need to protect those type of investors by making sure that you have, you know, strong transparency obligations. And that's the objective of a lot of the new measures that we see.
So in practical terms, we're talking about, I don't know, like these kid documents or whatever they have to read before they are permitted to buy them.
Kid, I think, is a very good example. So that's really, you know, two-pager, very straightforward information. You know, any investor should be able to understand that. That's the goal. But I think more broadly, I think this is part of your fiduciary duty as a manager. You need to make sure that whatever you're producing as an investment product and the selling documentation is clear, understandable, and adapted to the audience. That's a very important point.
And that's also the reason why actually it's key to have the right partners to distribute the fund, because they would be the one actually discussing with the clients at the end. So they will be presenting the product and giving all aspects about risks, return, etc. So that's something that is key. And at the end of the day, it was what Nicolas said in terms of type of documents that we need to provide it. That would be provided at the level of the sales team.
So you're saying actually the obligations for transparency may well fall on the intermediaries then?
Because the responsibility will remain at the level of the managers, but still the distributors will have to provide everything to the investors.
Right. Nicolas, valuation, it's another big problem with private assets, surely.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about it because, you know, we talk a lot about liquidity, but I think the other key component here is valuation. And again, here, valuation means a very different thing from what, you know, managers were used to do in the private fund institutional world. So historically, valuation really means reporting, right? So you're giving annual or quarterly reports to investors on, you know, showing the value of their investment. You do this at fair value, but it's all based on estimated values, models. So you're estimating the value of your investment portfolio. But at the end of the day, for those investors, what they get is cash. That's what's important. They pay and then they get the distributions. Same thing for the manager. They get paid, you know, through a cash waterfall. So it's all based on cash. It's very different if you're talking about the semi-liquid funds where investors come in, come out on those estimated values. So yeah, there's actual trading on those estimated values, which means that the exercise of valuation has a whole different meaning.
And do you think regulators are going to be therefore scrutinizing these valuation models more carefully?
I think that has started already. I think even looking at it from a reporting perspective, I think this has been the focus of the regulator for the last few years. And looking at recent measures like LTIF2, for instance, there's a lot of focus on valuation.
So you think, Nicolas, so if I walked into the CSSF office, this is a topic of conversation within their walls? You think they're talking about it?
I think so, yeah. It's it's a key point in getting any fund authorized, but it's also a kind of ongoing concern of the regulator, making sure that managers have the right process in place and that they're, you know, accountable for that.
Right, we've talked about transparency and open communication. What about investor relations? Do you think that's going to change in this context?
I think, Alexander, you alluded to that earlier. I think that the dynamic is very different, you know, in the private fund space versus the retail funds, which is by definition quite, you know, well intermediated, whereas managers on the private fund side are used to speaking to a handful of very big clients on a regular basis, and that's how the relationship is created and maintained. It's a different thing when you now need to talk to, you know, private banks and other distributors who have their own clients base to manage.
Right, Alexandre, I want to come back to you now about distribution. What are some of the key challenges that you're seeing for managers on the distribution side?
I think that when we speak about distribution, I can see two different challenges or two different areas where there are challenges for managers. One being the lack of efficient regulatory framework to market the funds or to register the fund to access the market. And the second in how to organize the distribution itself, the distribution network, how to create a strong link with the distributors and the right partners. So the first one, really, the access to the market for the products still remain a real barrier for managers because the way you can access the market is not harmonized at all. So you really need to focus on the local regime. And this is very complex. And you definitely need to do an assessment and a detailed analysis of what you can do. The point is that there are still options, obviously, depending on the type of investors that you are targeting. And we said before that that would not be the pure retail investors. So if you target like semi-professional investors, you can still have access to the market via the marketing passport. And if you want to go beyond those criteria, then you would need to really look at the regime that are applicable locally and make sure that this is possible, because in some countries, it's not allowed at all to reach or to register your funds to sell to retail investors, like in France, for instance.
But fortunately, there are other EU countries that are more open.
Yes, there are still countries where you can register your fund. It's not an easy process. It's quite complex, but still there are a few countries where it's possible. But again, before doing that, clients would have to do that feasibility assessment, and it's quite long. And yeah, if you want to access the market quickly, that can be problematic.
Right, so because this is going to take 6 months maybe to access a market.
Could be, yeah.
Right.
Could be, because we have like countries where you authorization is granted around 4 months after the file has been submitted. So before you need to prepare everything to be provided to authorities. So, yeah. And yeah, so that's and recently, actually, we had a case of a client who wanted to set up like a RAIF in Luxembourg, and they wanted to sell it in 4 or 5 European countries. So we did that feasibility assessment, and they realized that depending on the countries they have chosen, that was even not possible or so long that they finally went for a RAIF still, but supplemented by the ELTIF label, which would allow them to benefit from the marketing passport.
Got it. So, which is why you guys are in business, because actually these decisions are really quite complex to know, aren't they? And by experience, you've done it for one client, so you can share that wisdom a little bit with your next one.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, effectively. But the context is never the same. Actually, the context of our clients is never the same. So they always have like small differences where you cannot just say what is applicable to one is applicable to the others, because they have internal constraints. So that's the point, yeah.
Right. You also just, I'm going to pick up on, you mentioned asset managers need to find the right partner.
Yeah, that's the second element that is quite, or the second challenge for managers.
Right, and this is the intermediation partner, isn't it, really? So we're talking about the next... We talked about retail banks, and are we seeing new forms of intermediaries be created?
Not necessarily new forms of intermediaries, but still the marketing intermediaries that are used to sell liquid funds to retail investors. They are not really educated to sell to AIFs, to retail investors. So that's first to find the right partner to be able to sell to retail investors that kind of product. They have to be able to speak about that kind of product, which is quite different. And also probably, and yeah, not probably, but surely, it's important to have like a strong link to partners who have already like a huge clientele in terms of retail investors, but because that's not that easy to find.
Because it's all about the network.
All about the network, definitely, yeah.
Now, I'm going to bring all of you in on this question now, because digitalization is a big part of this whole market evolution. Do you think it's going to help bridge some of these difficult gaps and challenges that we've highlighted?
In terms of digitalization, I think that we cannot speak about distribution without speaking about digitalization, because investors now, the easy access to investments, to products. But still, I would say it's quite key to really focus on investment advice and getting the right advice to invest into the right product. So I think it's necessary not to forget about human factor.
Ah, so what about you, Nicholas? Where do you stand? Is it human factor or digitalization?
Well, I think they're not exclusive, right? So I think digitalization, on one hand, really helps kind of the end user experience, and we need that. And, you know, this is more and more present in our day-to-day life, in everything that we do. So there's kind of the investor perspective. It will never replace, I think, the advice, as Alex just said, but it's part of how funds and anything else basically is sold today. I think another big advantage and necessary, let's say, pushing us into digitalization is really kind of the link that you have to make between investors, distributors, you know, transfer agents, fund managers. There's a whole chain there of interconnected pieces that form the fund distribution channel. And for still a big part of the industry, actually, it's still a very manual process. And so I think there, if you want to go into the next phase, you know, bring scalable product to the markets, digitalization is something that needs to happen and needs to accelerate.
And Fiona, what's your view on this? Is digitalization a key part of this?
I mean, I completely agree with what's been said. I mean, we spend so much time on our phones nowadays. It's obvious that the industry needs to adapt, because the retail investor is not going to want to go to his bank and have a face-to-face meeting and discuss things in person. They will want to have access to all these services via their phones. But what's been said is also true. I mean, we can't forget about investment advice, investor protection. This is not something that's going to be easily done via phone. So I believe that there will be some kind of blend, and probably digitalization will ease certain like subscription processes and the onboarding of investors. But I don't think that we will see a complete replacement of the human, you know, the human factor, as Alexandra mentioned, in the coming years.
I mean, in some ways, it makes the regulator's job easier, because there's a paper trail or a digital trail for every part of the transaction. Do you think regulators are happy the fact that digitalization is accelerating?
I'm not sure they're necessarily that happy about it yet. obviously, we have regulations coming into play. But we're still very early in the process, and what's new doesn't always feel very comfortable for regulators, because that area has not yet been regulated. So all regulators will obviously need to adapt to this, but we're probably a little bit too early yet for them to feel comfortable about this yet.
Excellent. And on that note, we're now going to hear from Julien Gonter, also from Arendt Regulatory and Consulting.
LTIFs are not just a game changer of brand, but mark a significant change in the process. This is factually leading into mixing the industrialized way of operating for usage with the tailor-made approach of private assets. Even though private assets actors have made significant progress in digitalizing their process, we have two worlds who have factually never really talked together. And now they need to operationally work in a combined manner.
Now, Fiona, investor education is a really critical issue. I want to look at this whole subject now from the investor's perspective. What evolutions do you see there?
I mean, so as you said, Jim, investor education and information is key. We need to remember that these investors are not used to investing these types of strategies, these types of products. So we need to help them understand the constraints and risks that are attached to these funds. For example, and something that Nicolas has already touched upon, these products have much lower liquidity than funds that they typically invest into, such as UCITS. So they need to understand that when they're investing in these funds, it's longer term. It's not, I'll invest today and I'll redeem and get my money back tomorrow. And even so, because typically these funds will have quarterly redemption windows, so you can redeem and get your money back every 3 months. But let's also not forget that these funds are investing in illiquid assets. So it may well be that they need to implement certain liquidity management tools, which means that you getting your money back will be delayed, and you may have to wait even longer than what you'd anticipated.
But hang on a second. How do you make a bridge or road or something like that liquid?
So that doesn't become liquid. What is liquid is these funds will typically have liquid pockets. So they will have a certain percentage of their assets invested in liquid types of assets, very similar to what you would have in UCITS. But that's limited, right? It doesn't represent a huge proportion of the portfolio. So typically we will see 10%, 15%. But say you have a huge redemption surge, lots of investors wanted to come out of your fund at the same time. You're limited in terms of your liquidity pocket. So funds in that case will need to implement certain liquidity management tools to kind of manage this liquidity and not, you know, have to sell these illiquid assets at a loss, for example, which would not be in the best interest of the fund or the remaining investors.
So therefore, when LTIF or LTIF 2.0 was created, I guess they thought about this problem. And have they limited, for example, the amount of capital that can be invested into illiquid assets?
So no. And let's also go back, because under LTIF 1.0, LTIFs were closed-ended funds. So they were typically being created for a period of 8 to 10 years, where investors would more or less be committing to these 8 to 10 years and would not therefore be getting their money back before that time has elapsed. Under LTIF 2.0, the regulation is clearly foreseeing, you know, semi-open structures. So structures where you are also getting redemption windows at certain frequencies. What's not clear yet, and what's the subject of the current discussions and the consultation that has just closed at the end of August, is how these will be regulated. Because the ESMA has launched a consultation on the RTS that will come to supplement the LTIF 2.0 regulation, where all these questions are being addressed. So how frequently will an investor will be able to redeem? What's the notice period that they will need to give? What's the minimum holding period that they will need to hold their investment for before they're even able to ask for a redemption? And one of the questions is also, should we impose a minimum liquidity pocket for the LTIFs? These are obviously very complex questions. A one-size-fits-all approach is very difficult to to foresee for our asset managers, our clients whom we've discussed these points with, because obviously these strategies have very different, they have very different strategies and liquidity profiles. So it's a one size fit all is quite true.
Now, investor education, guys, should this all become digital or do we still need humans to be involved with investor education?
I think you can do a lot through, you know, digital content and the way you present the information. That's all very useful. But I think, as Fiona explained, these things are very complex. And I think where the industry still needs to figure out some things here is how do we make sure that investors fully understand what the terms are and how they should work. And they're going to be different from one strategy to another. So there's indeed lots of conditions imposed by regulation. But at the end of the day, your product is going to be mostly driven by the strategy, by the assets. So the liquidity that you can offer will depend on that. And I think that's a really important point for investors to understand that, yes, we have all these conditions and they actually might need to be applied. And that's kind of a normal thing because you're investing in, you know, private assets, illiquid assets. So a fund that needs to apply those liquidity management measures in this context is pretty normal.
I mean, Alexandra, you talked about intermediaries before. Do you think this topic of investor education, where do you see it going between the divide between providing digital information and still having to actually hire people to explain the product?
I think definitely, and if you look at the regulation, definitely you have to provide a suitability assessment. That's something you have to do. So taking into account the digitalization, you won't be in a position to avoid or reduce the implication of human, because that kind of suitability or appropriateness test would have to be done.
But they can click a few boxes and say, I think this product is suitable for me, can't they?
Yes, that'd still be applicable. And even if you have that suitability test, they could click on things. And even if finally the conclusion is that the product is not suitable to you, you can still invest into it. So, but that's a risk that the investor has to take. He needs to
That's a risk
understand.
For any product. Really.
Exactly.
It's not specific, but it's true that because it's all new, the risk of kind of mis-selling is increased, and it's a real challenge for managers.
And actually, you mentioned an interesting word there about mis-selling. How important is it in these early days of LTIF that we don't have a mis-selling scandal?
I think it's key, honestly. If we want to build on this LTIF vehicle to really build a scalable market, private market funds in Europe, I think it's very key that we take it step by step, make sure that the LTIF becomes a known brand, just like the UCITS brand is now, you know, globally recognized. Obviously, if there is a big scandal, mis-selling scandal around one of these funds, that could be very detrimental to the whole market.
Yeah, and it would really affect the retail investors' faith and appetite for these types of products. So it could really push us back a few years before we gain again the trust of these investors. So it is fundamental.
Now, in your experience right now, is there a lot of enthusiasm in the market for these products, Fiona?
Huge. It is. I'd say it's the hot topic of the moment. It has been for a couple of years, but it's definitely not dying down. I mean, we're seeing all types of asset managers, interested in creating these types of products, whether they come from the traditional liquid UCITS world, or on the private assets. So obviously our traditional UCITS managers are looking to tap into this private market because of the yield, the interesting yield that we've seen in the last few years. And on the private asset side, as Nicolas mentioned, getting institutional money has proved more difficult in recent years. And they obviously see this whole potential at the retail investor level, where, you know, you mentioned this, Jim, in your interview, that only 10% of money from retail investors is actually invested in funds. So there's obviously a huge potential there.
And the access to the market of the product is really key. I mean, they can go through the marketing on an harmonized process, which is not available, as I said before, to any other kind of product except UCITS. So that's quite key.
Right. Now, due to the huge number of uncertainties in the markets, of course, because yields may change, interest rates may change, we may have, who knows, what's going to happen with the EU economy. Do you think that we're going to see a continued evolution in LTIF, or do you think is the structure and the rules that we've got now, are these here to stay?
I think this is just the start. I mean, LTIF 2, as Fiona explained, LTIF 1 hasn't been a real success, although maybe in the last...
I mean, yeah, you said earlier there's only been 90 created.
There's only 90, that's a small number. However, if you look at the trend, we can see that a lot of structures have been created in, you know, the last 2 years. And if you actually look at the number of LTIFs, let's say, in the making, I think, you know, this number will more than double quite shortly, in my view. So there was, I think, already a lot of interest in the last couple of years around under the current regime. But now that we're talking about the new regime with all the improvements, as Fiona explained, I think there's clearly a lot of interest, renewed interest from managers for this vehicle, simply because it really, you know, it checks all the boxes. Huh? It's in terms of product, it's really adapted to the asset class, so it's a long-term investment fund. It has, you know, diversification rules. It's a regulated fund. Let's not forget about that. As I explained, it can be closed or open, so we can accommodate all the terms that we need. But then, more importantly, it really solves the distribution issue that Alex explained, because of the access to the passport. So that's a real game changer for managers, because that's what you need to build, you know, scalable, affordable products.
Now, I know that when Luxembourg goes on their roadshows around the world in Asia and other places, they often wave the UCITS banner. If we're having this conversation in 2 or 3 years, will they be having LTIF roadshows in Singapore?
It's likely to be, actually.
I think we already do.
Yeah, we already do, yeah, probably. But yeah, that's something it's likely to be the new retail brand in terms of... but in the alternative investment funds, and it would be quite key to become like the new brand, because so far in non-EU countries, for instance, that's really difficult to access the market for non-professional investors. Only UCITS can be sold to retail investors. No AIFs in certain countries. So that will be quite key that those non-EU regulators recognize the brand as being the new brand for retail investors.
Now, let's just talk about digitalization again, because we can't get away from this topic. I want your prediction that what percentage of funds do you think will be bought by a digital method going forward, let's say in 2 years' time? Alexandra, what percentage?
40.
Fiona?
No, I don't believe it's going to move that quickly. I think maybe 15.
15, Nicola?
Maybe something in the middle there. I think this is really, we need to understand this is a long-term trend. This is just the start. Of course, things are moving very fast. So, you know, who knows in 2 years. But I think there's a lot of work to do to get to... same level of maturity of that market that, you know, we have on the UCITS side, for instance.
Got it. Now, we're going to take another break right now, and I'm just going to hand over to Julian again from Arendt Regulatory and Consulting.
One example is the transfer agent process. Historically, private asset managers had to deal with a small number of limited partners. When we go into an LTIF, we are speaking about thousands of investors. In this case, the UCITS way of managing the investors' onboarding and registrar would be important to leverage on.
Thank you, Julian. Now it's back to our three guests here in the studio. Now, of course, let's just talk about the Luxembourg economy. Investment funds are a hugely important part of that. Do you think, are LTIFs going to become so popular that it's actually going to have a bearing on the scale of the industry here in Luxembourg, Fiona?
I think there is huge potential. I mean, Luxembourg is already very well placed in terms of the jurisdiction of choice for LTIFs. As I mentioned before, our clients, promoters, asset managers have chosen Luxembourg to create LTIFs that are being distributed on a pan-European basis. This is very unlike other jurisdictions which also have LTIFs, because, for example, France have got a certain number of LTIFs that have been created there, Italy the same, but those have been really created for the local market. And so far, we haven't really seen any other jurisdictions really having these LTIFs being created for broad distribution across the EU. So there's huge potential for Luxembourg. And with LTIF 2.0, obviously, we just expect that number to increase, which would obviously have repercussions on the whole industry here in Luxembourg, whether it's AIFMs, depositories, service providers. I mean, that means additional work, additional funds. There could potentially be a huge beneficial impact for Luxembourg.
Now, Nicholas, do you agree?
I fully agree. I think Luxembourg has really a unique position there. And that's really because it's probably the only country which can claim a long track record and strong track record both on the UCITS and AIF private market funds. So the combination of that really makes puts Luxembourg in a very unique position to really build on the Luxembourg fund model, as we call it, with very strong foundations in terms of structuring flexibilities and all the different types of funds that Fiona explained, strong investor protection standards, experienced regulator, the whole substance and kind of governance center that has been built in Luxembourg over the years, all of that really kind of converge towards making Luxembourg, the right place to set up those funds and also be this really global distribution hub for these type of funds in the same way that we've played that role on the UCITS side and on the institutional fund side.
But yeah. Guys, we're not the only European jurisdiction doing alternatives, are we? Come on, Alexandra, be fair here.
Yeah, actually, it's true that there are others like Ireland, but still, I mean, we are the one where the funds are set up the most. I don't have the statistics in mind, but I think we are still on the first place. And if I may add something to what we just said, in Luxembourg, we also have the right distribution partners, the platforms, and the idea is really to start from the marketing from Luxembourg throughout those platforms that are quite known and the new ones that will be created. So I'm actually convinced that Luxembourg will be the right place for that.
So you expect to see some new platforms here also, maybe, that we don't exist yet?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, there are new actually that are constantly being created. So we expect that there will be some in the next weeks or months.
Well, it sounds like quite an interesting time for Luxembourg as a jurisdiction. Guys, we're just about out of time right now. For people who have listened to our podcast this morning, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to summarise what is one key point that you'd like them to take away from our conversation. Nicholas?
Well, I think I've said it before. In my view, this is only the beginning, right? The market has evolved very rapidly in this space in the last couple of years, but it's still early days. And we see this really as a kind of fundamental shift in the industry. And as a long-term trend, we really need to allow, you know, time to build solid foundations for that.
Fiona?
I'd say I'd summarize it in two words, risk and regulation. So we're in the middle of a learning curve. The market is moving very fast, but we need to ensure that the applicable regulation keeps on evolving to investor needs and market needs, whilst ensuring investor protection, which is key.
And Alexandra?
I would say, don't forget the human factor. That's something I've actually raised a couple of times today. But really, to achieve your goal properly and optimally, the way sales team are selling the products should be adjusted to the product itself. And this is key to actually appoint the right partners. That is fundamental.
Absolutely, Alexandra. Thank you very much. And that was Aaron's We Live number 10, Unlocking Private Markets for Retail Investors, How We Are Reshaping the Alternative Funds Industry. Thank you.